From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, as Thanksgiving approaches, doctors and patients are thankful for advances in genome science. Later, portion size drops in some Milwaukee restaurants, striking a blow for trying new things.
If you order something that you've never had before, you're not committing to a $25 entree. You're maybe committing to an $8 small plate.
Why astronomers are excited about two comets moving through our solar system.
What is interesting is that the two comets are very close to Mercury, and Mercury has an orbiter going around it called Messenger. So we're going to get super close pictures.
And memories of a Wisconsin department store of days gone by. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Genomic researchers at Children's Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin made news in 2010 when they successfully used genome sequencing to diagnose and treat a child with a rare medical condition. In the 3 years since, genome research hasn't slowed down. A study by another Milwaukee researcher has identified genes related to a complex speech disorder affecting children. But her work has broader implications that could lead to greater understanding of many more issues involving the human genome. Dr. Liz Worthy is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Medical College and director of genomic informatics for the Genome Medicine Clinic at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin and at the Medical College. She is with us now in the studio to tell us more about it. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me along.
I want to start with this most recent study linked to childhood apraxia. This is a complex issue for the young patients who have it. What was it that you set out to determine, and what did you find?
So we really wanted to see, there's been a lot of movement into genomic medicine in a variety of areas, most of them related to diseases that are believed to be Mendelian in nature, meaning that there is a single gene defect that's controlled them. And what we wanted to do, or my particular interest, was something a little bit more complex. So moving more into complex genetics where multiple genes are believed to be having an effect. And we wanted to see whether we could really take this technology that's been used in a fairly small number of different types of diseases and push it into something a little bit new and different.
Well, and so apraxia was one of these conditions that was initially believed to be linked to a single mutation?
It was originally, but then people who worked in the field believed it was more heterogeneous. So that there was what they had done is they found an initial gene that was associated with it, and then they started checking people with apraxia, and they found that a very small percentage of individuals had a defect in that gene. And so the belief was that there was other genes that were being involved. And there was also a question about whether it was a single gene or not.
And so the research bore this out?
It did. So what we did, we ended up doing whole exome sequencing of a number of children, we being myself and Larry Schreiberg, and he's really the expert in apraxia.
And remind us the difference. What's the significance of the concept of an exome?
So with exome sequencing, you're sequencing about 1.2% of the whole genome, and you're focused on the part of the genome that encodes for proteins. So it's a far cheaper approach. It costs maybe a third of the price, and you get less data, but you do get most of the pieces that are currently known to be associated with disease. And so it was actually ARA funding that Larry had got to do this sequencing. And the amount of funding that he got meant that we did exome and not whole genome. We did it in 10 patients, and we found that a number of different genes that were involved, some which had been previously related to the disease, but also some novel ones. And perhaps most interestingly, we found that in some of the patients, they had defects in more than one gene. The defects were perhaps milder than those which cause some other monogenic diseases, but it was kind of an accumulation of smaller changes that gave rise to the disease.
On one level, it sounds like a positive development that we know more. But does the more complex cause mean that finding treatments is necessarily going to be that much more challenging because you are dealing with more than one gene here?
Not necessarily. So a treatment is normally not for a specific gene. A treatment is normally for a particular pathway within a cell, so the interacting set of genes. And so what we actually found is a number of those genes were part of the same pathway. And it's the pathway going wrong that you treat with the drug. And in actual fact, above and beyond that, finding more genes increases our knowledge about how broad and diverse that pathway is. And it may even get us into other pathways that already have drugs for them that can be then used in these cases potentially.
Well, and so using apraxia as an example, is this knowledge that you have gained through this likely to have a fairly fast impact on how someone at the treatment level might work to help a patient?
So there's two parts to that. So in terms of the development of a drug, I don't think it will be particularly fast. And the reason I don't is because we're talking about neurons and fine, small changes. And having a drug that you could use to make that alteration without affecting another part of that network would be fairly difficult. But hopeful in down the road. Surely, if we don't understand it at all, we're not going to get a treatment. But if we do understand it a little now, then we can start working towards that. But the other part of it is really been able to work out that these children early on have this type of speech problem and not some other type, so something more to do with the muscles. And with the correct diagnosis, then they can go down the correct care plan path. So I think that's very important.
So this is as much about ruling out other causes as it is about figuring out what to do about this particular cause.
Absolutely.
For people who aren't genome scientists, and there may be one or two of them listening, is the rapid pace of development at this stage related more to more powerful computing abilities or better software programming or some other technological leap or all of the above?
Both on the sequencing side and on the computational side. The real change that happened over the last few years has been the sequencing technology. But if we had only had that and not the rapid development on the computational side, we wouldn't have been able to do anything with the data. And now we're at a point where, to some extent, the sequencing is easy. And it's all computational. All of the challenges are computational.
I feel like I've used this metaphor in a previous interview with someone. Originally, I think there was the issue of, you know, essentially drinking from the fire hose. There was so much data. And so do I get from what you're saying that it no longer is drinking from the fire hose?
So I think – so to use that same analogy, we now have a filter that we can put on the fire hose to get the data out of it that we can use just now to make diagnosis and understand what's going on. However, at the same time, the rest of the data that's still in the fire hose is data that we need if we are to be able to treat everyone who has any type of disease. So we need to work out how to open it back up a little bit so that we can use that data.
Well, and talk more about that other data, because you were saying that, you know, one of the beauties of exome sequencing is that you're looking at, you know, just over 1% of the whole genome, and it's protein related, and this is where most of the disease information is. What's in the rest of the genome?
All the rest of the interesting stuff. So for me, I'm a genome person. I think the genome is the way to go. The reason that most of the variants that have been associated with disease are in the exome is because that's the only place we've looked so far. We tended to be very gene-centric. But clearly, there's lots of missing heredity in all of these disorders that have a genetic component, and it's going to be in the part that's not in the exome. Things that used to be called junk a long time ago, then turned out to be what caused Fragile X syndrome and many of these other disorders. So for me, we have to do whole genome so we can learn.
Are there things that we don't even know that we don't know yet?
Always. I think that's why we do what we do. So really, we're entering a phase now with genomics where we're starting to come back to hypothesis-driven research using genomic data. So we're starting to realize some of the things that we don't know that we want to do, and we're starting to ask those questions. But now, because we've got data, we can come back and answer those questions and come up with the next questions.
How long have you been in this field?
15 years.
Well, what is your feeling about how much of the promise of genome research is being realized today, especially compared to where it was when you were getting into the field? It seems like 15 years is almost a lifetime in this area.
So when I started my PhD was really when genomics data was starting to be made available. And it took me 3 years to do what would take me a week or less now. I think we now have 50 or 60 new causal associations with disease coming every month, which is completely different from even where it was back in 2005, where we had 80 a year. So we're right at that inflection point. We now have the ability to have enough data. We've got the computational hardware to analyze it. All of that background over the last 10 years, it's right now. Right now is when we take off, and we already are starting to take off.
But the people who are in this for the devising treatments really have their work cut out for them with this much more information to deal with.
Well, that's going to be the next challenge. We're already seeing a furore of papers coming out around functional studies, around what we find in individuals' genomes associated with their disease. Pharma are starting to be really interested in this for a variety of reasons. So it's the application of the knowledge. Applied science used to be a dirty word. We're all meant to do theoretical, but now the application is what we all need to work on.
Liz Worthy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Liz Worthy is Director of Genome Informatics for the Genome Medicine Clinic at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin and the Medical College of Wisconsin. She's also Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at the Medical College. Her findings on genetic defects in childhood apraxia were published recently in the Journal of Neurodevelopmental Disorders. Portion sizes are shrinking at some Milwaukee-area restaurants. Why, some see that as a good thing in general. When Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Portion size. It's a major bone of contention for many people who eat out in this country. You hear the complaints. People would be willing to pay the same cost if only the amount of food were limited to what one could reasonably expect to eat in one sitting. It turns out that there are some restaurants who are thinking along those lines as well, and some of them are in Milwaukee. Dining critic and Lake Effect contributor Ann Christensen writes about the trend towards smaller plates in the cover story in the December issue of Milwaukee Magazine and highlights some of the restaurants working with a smaller plate concept. She tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon what is driving the trend nationally and locally.
Oftentimes what the chef might have a special thing going on or a very small amount of something that's a seasonal ingredient or some special ingredient, it is only a very, you know, minuscule amount of something. And yet it's usually something with a lot of flavor, a lot of texture, a lot of spark, color, everything. And I think it pretty much thumbs its nose at Milwaukee's, you know, reputation for
strapping on the feedback.
Strapping on the feedback, exactly.
Now, the restaurants that you focused on here, I believe there are 20. Is that right?
Yeah, there are 20 restaurants, but I also cover cocktails because a number of these places do interesting craft cocktail lists. There are other components as well. I have a matrix that talks about the price range, you know, because those can vary. And you can also get into the idea of how small plate sizes even can vary depending on where you go.
Is the small plate the focus, or are there only a few? Like La Miranda, that's small plates. But some of these are small plates, and you could have regular entrees if you prefer.
Yes, because chefs might tell you. Some chefs might say this is the way they like to eat themselves, or it's the way they see the dining public that direction. The terms of restaurants, that's the way it's going. But yes, there are restaurant La Miranda. Their whole menu is exclusively small plates. Odd Duck is almost all small plates. They have maybe four or five large plates. Same with the new restaurant AP. So it's a combination of restaurants where either their entire menu or a large component of the menu is small plates, Or it's something like at Mason Street Grill, in their bar, they've got a special lounge small plate menu that you only order there. So it's a number of different, you know, restaurants and ways of eating and parts of their menu.
One of my first impressions was that this is, what a great idea for people who are indecisive.
Absolutely. I mean, although at the same time, you could argue that maybe that makes it worse because, you know, a small plate menus are often huge, you know, so if you've got like 20 small plates on there, honestly, I go to Odd Duck and I want to order everything and can't. So I think in a way that almost makes it worse if you're indecisive. But then on the same token, and this is an argument for small plates, if you order something that you've never had before, you're not committing to a $25 entree. You're maybe committing to an $8 small plate, right? You can share. And the whole rubric, the whole thinking behind this is that you're probably going to share it with another diner or two or more diners. And so everybody's having it, you know, eating it. And if it's something new and you don't like it, that's okay. Someone else will eat it.
And that point is mentioned many times in the article, just about trying something new or being adventurous. Including pig's ears.
Yeah, which
is... I mean, this is the time to try it, I guess, if it's a small
plate.
Yeah,
yeah, and it's actually one of the really fun little finger foods that they offer at the bar at Rumpus Room. And I shouldn't say just at the bar. I mean, if you're seated in the dining room, you can get it as well. And it really is just a little bowl full of these little fried, kind of like almost look like French fry shaped somewhat, I suppose, pieces of a pig's ear. And it's deep fried and, you know, it's battered, deep fried, and then you dip it in an aioli, which is a seasoned mayo, and it's delicious. Yeah, you can try fried pig's ears. You can try fried sweetbreads. You could try duck testes, which have been on the menu at Hinterland. But, you know, with a number of these, I have to say, one of the big challenges of doing the story.
That must be a really small plate, by the way.
Well, it depends on how many testes we're talking about. One of the challenges of this story was, you know, a lot of the small plate menus change often. So if I'm working 2 or 3 months in advance, that made it difficult to photograph foods, for one thing, that are dishes that might still be available. And also having the chef tell me what they might be thinking about making 2 or 3 months from now. Although there is some measure of continuity with certain things, like you might always have a scallop dish. It's just presented in a different way, seasonally, as it were. Or, you know, for instance, these fried pig's ears, it's become a very popular thing at the bar. So I don't think those are really going to go away. I found, looking at all these menus, that there were trends, you know, there were certain things that certain ingredients that seemed to come up often. For instance, over the summer, it was kale. A lot of people were doing kale salads. And I was looking for, you know, an ingredient that was coming up pretty frequently at various restaurants. Like everybody was doing meatballs or, you know, something like this. But I found by far the most common thing that restaurants were doing was pork belly, which in some ways seemed like something that had been around a long time to me. It kind of felt like, well, pork belly, everybody's had pork belly, or it's so common now. But it's really common, and you will almost always find it. But, you know, I got to tell you, it's pork belly is delicious. It's great stuff. And a lot of people know what it is, so they're not afraid to order it.
Why is it everywhere? I mean, are all these things just coincidences that they all happen to have meatballs or they all happen to have kale? I mean, is there some kind of conspiracy going on here?
It is a conspiracy. No, I think, you know, and I kind of I do not overstate the pork belly thing, because it really is as omnipresent as I've found it to be. You know, there's a lot of it out there.
It was worthy of its own little section.
Yeah, it really was. Yeah. But, okay, meatballs, maybe not as much. Quail eggs, however, I'm seeing quail eggs almost. Everybody wants to put a component of an egg on some kind of dish. You know, I don't know. I think it's just, I think there's some things that are, you know, maybe really, they're easy to get. They're seasonal. They found a really good supplier for it. It can work really well with certain ingredients. They're just like anything else, it becomes popular. You know, it doesn't mean everybody has it, but for a time, maybe someone will have it as a component. I don't know why kale, for instance. I think part of it is, I mean, I've been reading more about kale. You see it more. And kale, not just cooked, it's a raw in a salad. So I don't know, maybe people are just discovering it more. So I don't know, but pork belly was one of the things that I found that, you know, it's hard to go to a place and not find pork belly, some component.
But your article illustrates well how differently it's prepared, though. It's not just the same kind of preparation.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
What was your favorite?
Pork belly?
If you can even pick favorites here.
Wow, it's so hard to say. I have to say carnivore. It's sort of their one of their signature dishes on the menu is a ravioli, a homemade ravioli. And then the filling is there's a confit and pork belly filling inside the ravioli. So and it's pretty delicious. And that's one that I don't see. It's been on the menu a long time. That is kind of a little standby. If I were to go there, I probably would, always try to order that. Mm-hmm. I think that one is really delicious.
You mentioned earlier the one of the restaurants, just kind of the number of choices you have with small plates seems to be more in some cases.
Yes.
So how does one go about pairing these with each other? I mean, some entrees, chefs have created these with each of the dishes as part of the entree in mind with each other and the wine, whatever. So, but here you have this kind of mishmash of things you can pick from. And should you even look at it as a pairing or just get what you want?
I don't really look at it as a pairing. That's not the way I would order. I would just order things that sound really good to me and interesting or unusual or something I've never had. I mean, but that's the way I would approach it. Some people might look at it, though, and say, well, I want to approach it a little bit more like I would a straightforward menu that has appetizers, salads, and entrees. So then they might want to order something. The first one, they might want it to come out as courses and have the first one be like a vegetable or a cheese plate or something, you know, and then move to something that is more meat-oriented that seemed more like an entree. Do you know what I'm saying? And I think that makes sense. I don't approach it that way. I don't mind having a cheese. In fact, I'd love to have a cheese course at the end because I like that. I like that. And I like that as kind of in the place of a dessert, too. So I don't think there's any rules to it, in essence.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
How about pairing wines for those that always have wine with dinner? Seems like it's just kind of a crazy thing to do. You can't pair a wine with all these divergent different dishes.
Well, you know, and I don't know that people say that you have to necessarily or any more that people say white. You drink white if you're having fish, right? And you always drink red if you're having red meat. I don't even know if that's even true anymore. Again, I feel like you should drink what you like. I mean, if you're someone who likes, you know, Chardonnays, but you don't like red wines, why would you order a red wine because someone says, oh, this is going to be better with your ribeye small plate, and it's not even a wine that you even like? That doesn't make any sense to me.
So does that rule go out the window then? I'm not just the traditional pairings, but the idea that wines do go better with, as you said, certain foods, but you're going to have so many different kinds of foods.
I'm not going to throw that out the window because I do think that there are wines that really are enhanced or enhance food, enhanced by or enhance what you're eating. Do you know what I'm saying? Uh-huh. I think there definitely are. But I also think that you should order what you like. Right. So that's my – and it's the same with cocktails.
So that these the drinks become their own small plate in a way.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
All right. I just want to get your take on some of the criticisms of small plates is that it just jacks up the bill, you know, because you just want to have to keep getting more and more small plates. What do you think about that?
It can. I think you absolutely can have that happen. And I've had it happen to me. You know, you get lost in the joy of or whatever of the moment, and you've got all these friends around and you're thinking, oh, yeah, I want this and I want this and I want this. And in your mind, you're saying, oh, I know that's maybe $6 or $7, but you're not really tallying it, you know. And then once you get the bill, you think, oh, my God, you know, I spent as much as I would have if I ordered, I don't know, a 3-course meal at a more traditional sort of place. I think it can happen. Absolutely. You know, there are definitely small plates that you're going to order that are $18, $19 at some restaurants. Okay. So You know, they're not all going to be $5 or $10. There is some sticker shock there. But I also don't know that I would recommend small plates to everyone. I am related to people who would say, oh, that's not enough food for me. I'll never fill up on that. And that's an argument that I've heard too. And yet I feel like you can. I don't really necessarily believe that, but I've heard it.
Well, you mentioned that expensive plate. I liked the Matrix. There are four parts of the Matrix,
yes,
which are both the traditional and edgy, and then there's the spendy and thrifty.
Right.
And you placed most of these restaurants out onto this Matrix, which I liked. I thought it was a really fun way to look at it.
Well, obviously that was very – the edgy versus traditional was very subjective. I was the one who said, okay, well, this menu is a little bit more on the traditional end. This menu is a little bit out there, nonconformist, edgy. So I was the one who was labeling them, you know, these restaurants that way. But, I mean, obviously I'm just trying to help people, you know, sort of if they're looking for a restaurant that maybe is a little bit, you know, maybe has a little – as a steak – and potatoes and roasted Brussels sprouts, as opposed to a place that's, you know, where they're looking for, I don't know, a five-spice rubbed pork belly with Asian vegetables or something that, you know what I mean, that's a little bit more unusual.
All right. Well, thank you, Anne, for coming in. Happy holidays.
Thanks. You too.
Anne Christensen is dining critic and senior editor at Milwaukee Magazine. She also writes the Dish on Dining column for the magazine's website. She is also our regular dining contributor, and she spoke with Dan Harmon. Her article on small plates is the cover story in the December issue, which is on its way toward subscribers this week and will be on newsstands next week. Two comets may soon be streaking across a night sky near you. That's making some scientists pretty interested. We'll learn about them, the comets, not the scientists, when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. One of the hallmarks of this time of year is the likelihood you will either have visitors coming to your house or you will be a visitor in someone else's. Lake Effect's astronomy contributor Gene Creighton tells Bonnie North our solar system is no exception.
We have two comets visiting us. One is called Encke, and it's getting very close to the sun. An astronomical unit is the distance between the Earth and the sun. And it gets 0.025 astronomical units away from the sun.
That's pretty close.
That's really close.
I mean, is that going to get sucked into the sun's gravity?
That close, you're taking a big chance,
yeah.
Yes. But what's interesting about Encke is that it's the comet that is responsible for the Taurid meteor shower. So on the 13th, 14th of November, we had a series of meteors that are connected to the fact that the Earth is traveling through the orbit of this comet.
Okay.
So although you're not going to hit, obviously, the comet itself, you are more likely to pass through debris that the comet is shedding as it moves in its orbit. So that's why we can predict, we should have a meteor shower. So the other comet is the one that's gotten a lot of press. It's called Ison. And quite frankly, I might as well tell you, that shouldn't have been its name. Comets normally are named by the first people who saw them. But the two gentlemen who first discovered them had fairly long Russian names. So I suspect that given the choices, the media decided that they're going to call it after the network of people who observed it as opposed to the two individuals, which is the usual way.
Okay.
That is,
all right.
So that's how Ison has become the name. So this one is now inside the orbit of the Earth, closer to the sun, in other words, than that. On November 13th, 14th, it got a boost in its brightness by about 10 times. Now, this was first discovered a little over a year ago. And people have models of how a comet changes its brightness as it approaches the sun. And these models, of course, get fine-tuned as you get more data. And the original prognosis was that this was going to be the comet of the century, but it turns out, based on subsequent data, that it probably isn't going to be quite that bright, and its actual brightness depends on what is going to happen to the comet as it approaches the sun, which we'll talk in a little bit about. What is interesting is that the two comets are very close to Mercury, and Mercury has an orbiter going around it called Messenger. So we're going to get super close pictures of the comets as they're approaching the sun. So we'll get a pretty good idea, even if we don't get the data analyzed because things happen quickly, to be able to accurately predict what is going to happen. At least we're going to be able in hindsight to say, ah, these are the signs, this is what happened, and this is what eventually we got to see.
All right. So there are some possibilities, though, of what could happen to these comets, right?
That's right.
So it's not necessarily that they're going to go into the sun, although that's a possibility.
Oh, no. That is a possibility. There are basically three scripts. The first possibility is that it spontaneously disintegrates, and that could happen anytime. Fewer than 1% of comets disintegrate. So it is an unlikely script, but it's certainly not impossible. And it has already passed the 0.8 astronomical unit. So that is the zone where a disintegration could happen. But as I said, I think it's somewhat unlikely. The other nice thing to note is that in addition to Messenger, there are 10 large instruments that are watching ISON now all the time. So as I said, we're going to have plenty of data.
And fabulous pictures.
And fabulous pictures, that's right.
Yeah.
Even so we won't necessarily rely on ground-based pictures, of course, we'll have those too. The second option is that this comet that's made mostly of ice is going to get close to the sun within 1% of an astronomical unit. Its temperature is going to get up to 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. That's hot enough to vaporize not just the ice, of course, but also the dust and rock that it's made of. Now, that doesn't happen as quickly as you might think. The minimum size that is required for it to withstand some annihilation without completely falling apart is about 200 meters, and it's estimated now to be between 500 meters and 2 kilometers. So chances are it's going to survive getting super hot close to the sun.
It might get smaller, but it
will
survive.
Oh, yes. It will certainly shrink.
Okay.
And some of that might end up being a beautiful tail. But as you said, of course, the gravity of the sun is the big player in the solar system. It could be that it finds the sun irresistible and makes a headlong run toward the sun. But as I said, that is not quite as likely as the third script, which is that it survives. So it's going to be behind the sun, of course, but then eventually it's going to come around. And a beautiful description I heard is that it's going to be like a dog chasing its tail, whereas when the comet approaches the sun, the tail follows naturally. When it comes around, the tail is blown away from the comet, so it looks like the comet is going to be chasing its own tail. And in that case, with any luck, I mean, the absolute perfect script is that it breaks in two or three chunks at that point. That will allow more material to evaporate, which means that its tail is going to be more beautiful, more visible. And instead of having to wake up at, say, 4 o'clock in the morning, we will be able to see it around sunset. And that we should be able to do shortly after Thanksgiving, perhaps all the way to Christmas.
But that's only if that third script holds.
If it survives,
okay.
Yes. If it, in the meantime, spontaneously disintegrates, or if it makes a headlong dive to the sun, or it breaks into lots of pieces by the sun, that's not going to work. But the chances that it might survive its approach to the sun are pretty good at this point.
So let's assume that it does, and we get that wonderful light show over the next month or so. What happens to the comet after that? Is it continuing on a trajectory where?
It is going back to where it came from. This is one of the special, there are basically two classes of comets. There are the short-period comets and the long-period comets. So Halley's Comet, for example, is a short-period comet, and that will come every 75 years. So one could, in principle, see those two times in a lifetime. This is a long-period comet, and it comes from all the way out from the Oort cloud, which is 10,000 astronomical units away from the sun. So it's basically a quarter of the way between us, the sun, I should say, and the nearest star. So there's this whole sphere of frozen objects that somehow get perturbed, maybe by a passing star, and they sniff out the biggest gravitational field in the solar system, and that's why they head out to the sun. But the fact is that in most cases, those guys will go back all the way to the Oort cloud, which is going to take them a long time. So typically, we only get to see those guys once.
But would they come back?
They would.
Okay.
So if we're still here and we're still observing in, say, 40,000 years, we'll get to see it again.
So, you know, we just be prepared for visitors in 40,000 years.
You always need to be prepared.
Yes. Well, Jean Creighton, I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Thank you. I hope you do too.
And we will see you next month.
Very nice.
Lake Effect contributor Jean Creighton is director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium, located on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She spoke with Bonnie North about two celestial visitors to our solar system, the comets Encke and Ison. As we start to think about holiday shopping, a recent book takes us back to the heyday of a Wisconsin department store of years gone by. We'll get that story when Lake Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanksgiving is tomorrow, which means we are T-minus 2 days from Black Friday, the busiest shopping day of the year, though many stores this year have jump-started their post-Thanksgiving sales by making them into pre-Thanksgiving sales. There was a time, though, and it wasn't all that long ago, when Christmas shopping meant a trip downtown to a fancy department store. We all probably remember the big department store names from our past: Gimbel's, Schuster's, Marshall Field's, Woodward and Lothrop, and if you are from Marinette, Wisconsin, Lorman's. Author Michael Liana memorializes the store of the past in his recent book, Something for Everyone. Speaking with Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce in October, he talked about why the store held such personal appeal for him.
It was a wonderful place, and it was much like other department stores that used to exist all over. So I think telling the story was a good idea. I think it needed to be preserved. My father worked there for close to 50 years, and he was a department manager for many of those years. I wanted to honor him. This came up. It was an idea I had, and I went to some of the Lorman family members and asked them about it, and I said, if you don't want me to do it, I won't. But they all the ones I talked to said, go for it and do it. So, and they seem to be happy with it today. And doing this, I found out that it was very important to lots of people up there. As I interviewed more and more people, it was a really good topic. People enjoyed talking about it and remembering it.
What conditions made it right for the Lorman brothers to get together and open this store in Marinette?
When Marinette was a kind of a boom town, it was a lumber town, back around 1890 when the store opened, and the Lorman brothers, there were three brothers who came to Marinette from southern Wisconsin. They found this place that had a lot of potential, and they opened a small store and took it from there. The store expanded a couple of times, and then they built this big store that still exists right in the center of Marinette. And that's the store that most people think of when they think of Lorman's.
Now, there's a great story at the beginning of the book where the store almost didn't come to pass thanks to a chance encounter on a trip through Chicago.
Oh, yeah. It's a famous story in the family. I heard from different family members of the Lormans. Joseph Lorman was the oldest brother, and he took their savings and traveled to New York, actually, to buy merchandise when the store first opened, and he had the money hidden in his belt, I think. And he told the story later on that somebody he met in Chicago in between trains talked him into or wanted to talk him into going into a tavern and possibly throw some dice or something like that. And he said, if I hadn't resisted that, if I hadn't gotten out of there, I may have not had that money. They started the whole business with $1,100 that they saved up over a few years. And these two young brothers started the store. Then they recruited their younger brother, the youngest in the family, came up and helped them then. So there were three, but essentially two in the beginning. And apparently that may have happened to him in Chicago. And they think that the store might not got its start if he hadn't resisted that offer from that man.
That temptation. Mm-hmm. What was it about these brothers? What was their vision for this store? What did they want it to be? There were a lot of other stores in Marinette at that time.
The funny thing is the whole history of the department store is an interesting one, I think, that things were being done differently across the country and even over. The department store really began in Europe, but they started putting things together in stores rather than putting them in strictly clothes or strictly shoes. And the department store kind of came to be. Some people accepted it and some people didn't or embraced it. The Lormans had this idea and they succeeded at it. They put the right kinds of merchandise in there. A lot of the success is attributed to the fact that the people in Marinette appreciated their selection. They would have very good top-of-the-line merchandise, but they also would have items that were not of top quality but were more affordable. So they had a wide variety of things that appealed to a wide variety of people. So,
hence the title, Something for Everyone.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But you also identified other factors that attributed to its success. Can you talk about those?
Well, sure. They offered really good service. At one time, the department stores offered all sorts of little things, parades and fashion shows and little classes on how to use the bicycles in the bicycle department, how to use this new wax that they've sold for the floors. You know, they would offer all sorts of little things, free gift wrap and free delivery. When I talk to people today about Lormans or any old department store, people really respond because enough time has passed now and people kind of yearn for those days, I'm finding, when you could call and get good service, when you could buy something with the confidence that you didn't have to, worry that it wasn't going to be backed up. And here's just a little piece from the book. This is Jerry Blum, and he was the manager there eventually in the appliance department. And he said, on Monday mornings, we'd go out and oil up all the ringers and motors on customers' washing machines. I remember going to your grandma's. We'd oil up the machine, and she'd give us coffee and bakery. Before you knew it, we were outside hanging the clothes on the line. And it goes on from there. Yeah, it's amazing that people really did that. It sounds like when you talk to somebody younger today about this, it sounds like you're talking about a different planet almost, that where this kind of thing happened. Every one of these department stores across the country was unique, but each one kind of followed a parallel path. This is why when I wrote this book, I kind of kept that in mind, and I've been hearing from people who said they read it, they'd never even have been in Marinette, but they remember their hometown department store, and everything that's written in here reminds them of what they experienced too.
Yet each store did have something unique, and Lormans had a few unique features that really made going to the store an experience.
Yes. It just struck me after interviewing people that there were certain things that everybody wanted to talk about, so I started to make a note of that. The number one item for Lormans, and most people guess it right away, the malt ice cream cone was something unique to Lormans and Marinette. And everybody wants to know, how can I get one of those again? And I did a lot of research and talked to various people. And the conclusion in the end is, you won't ever get one again because the recipe is gone. The machines no longer are there. And perhaps I'll be proven wrong by somebody sometime. It was a very memorable part of going to Lorman's store. Some of the other things that were unique to Lorman's were not food related. One of the things people like to talk about when they talk about Lorman's is the elevator there, because in Marinette, Lorman's was the first store to have an elevator, or the first building to have an elevator, and people were just thrilled by it. They were frightened of it. They wouldn't go on it. They wouldn't let their children near it. Other people loved going on it. They thought it was such a thrill, and it was just a slow-moving little elevator that went up from the basement to the third floor.
What about the employee experience? What were some of the more interesting stories that you collected as you talked to people who had worked there?
There's an appendix at the end of the book with a list of names of people who worked there for 30 or more years, and the list is pretty long. You know, there were people there who came to ask about a job, and they ended up staying for half of a century. You know, it's amazing. There's a lot of them. And they today, by and large, they're very proud of their experience there, and they love talking about Lorman's store. People fondly remember it. They kind of yearn for those old days again. So I would get that feeling every time I talk with one of these people.
Was there a story that really stuck out to you?
Oh, there were several. Let's think. There was one woman who gave me the story that she went to apply for a job there, and she was told, well, we'll keep your name here and we'll keep in touch with you if something opens up. When she turned and left, she found on the stairway as she was leaving the store, she found a wallet on the floor and opened it up, and there were $60 in it. She returned it to that same man at the desk where she applied for the job and gave it to him. The next day, she was offered a job, saying, you were so honest, we want to give you the job. And she stayed there for 39 years. She also got a gift from the woman in Michigan who the wallet belonged to, some kind of a hand-embroidered set of pillowcases or something like that. You know, it's just, you know, there are a lot of stories like this.
So how does the story of Lorman's end?
Well, it's no fun to read that last chapter, but it's necessary to write that and to read that. The department store decline kind of started in the 20s, though. Without the Depression and without World War II, perhaps it would have gone under sooner. But those factors helped to make it a going concern for a greater number of years. In the 50s, there were some indications. In the 60s, for sure, that's when stores like Target and Kmart came along. And the 70s, the Lorman store was still going fine. Some of their satellite stores that they opened around 1930, they one by one went under. They had stores in Iowa and in Michigan and elsewhere in Wisconsin. In the end, in the 70s, the big store in Marinette was the only one left, and it finally closed in 1987. And that's probably about the same era when Prangies and Gimbel's and a lot of these stores went under. In the 80s, the business started to decline. And at one time, Lorman's Marinette had a store that employed 440 people around 1935, somewhere in there. And in the very end, there were 28 people employed full time. They consolidated different departments. They had whole sections of the store that were empty. And luckily, it still exists and stands in downtown Marinette. Many of these old department stores are gone. But there was not much anybody could do. This was happening all across the country. And it was just hard, you know, because this was a beloved place, and it was time to admit that we have to close.
If people have such strong memories, and it was so painful for a store like this to close, why do you think no one's trying again? No other set of brothers is trying to create the hometown department store.
Well, isn't that something, you know? Yeah, you'd think that something like that would be done. I do think that perhaps there has been some change in something such as a service, that service is returning a little bit, that people really like that. You know, the thing that made sense to me, and I never had thought about it, with Lorman's store, it was a great big building with high ceilings and beautiful marble columns and marble floor and these big grand show windows and everything. But when I spoke with one of the members of the Lorman family, he described to me and told me how much it cost to keep that place heated, the electricity, servicing the elevator, all that stuff. It was very expensive. And these other stores were coming in, building on the edge of town where land was cheaper. they could expand out and keep everything on one floor. I never had thought about the fact that no one ever used shopping carts in Lorimann's store. You just couldn't do it. And stores today are on one floor, and people grab a shopping cart when they first enter, and that's just the way it is. So I don't think these kinds of stores have much of a chance anymore just because of things like that. You know, it's times have changed. People's needs and demands have changed. I think it's too much to hope that enough people will demand a return to the old ways. But it is fun to think back and to look back at all these things.
Well, Michael Leanna, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about Lorimann's.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Michael Leanna's book is called Something for Everyone, Memories of Lorimann Brothers Department Store. A writer, radio playwright, and former public school employee, Leanna lives in Sheboygan. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce, and our interview first aired in October. That's Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. We'll have a mostly food-oriented version of the program for Thanksgiving. I hope you can tune in for that. If you are leaving town and leaving the Milwaukee area, have yourself a terrific Thanksgiving holiday. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I sure hope you'll join us tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air comes your way next. Have a great day.